The presenting sponsor of the Bloodstream Podcast is Takeda. And for that, we say thanks Takeda.
Hello, and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, episode 34, March 18th, 2019. I'm Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
On this episode, we discuss what questions to ask before participating in a clinical trial during our Like segment, how experts in the U.S. are struggling to think about gene therapy and rare disease drug pricing in our Comment segment, and Jonathan Hill's A Long Road is the feature in this month's Share segment, plus our first ever A Moment for Mental Health segment with Debbie De La Riva, and a sit-down interview with writer, director, producer Robert C. Cooper about his new show Unspeakable, covering the blood contamination crisis in Canada. All that and more coming up on this episode. Welcome to Bloodstream. People at home can't see this when they're listening, but we are currently surrounded by an assortment of yellow pillows, which is a new little feature we have today in our recording studio for the day.
In attempts to soak up the echo.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a technical term.
Yeah, that's right. Soaking up the echo.
Yeah.
It's podcast professional lexicon right there. Also, keep an ear out for a new Bloodstream Media podcast series coming out next. That's pretty good, right? Eyes and ears.
Shoulders, knees and toes, knees and toes.
Empowering Women, a new three-part series. Since 1999, a group of women with bleeding and clotting disorders have been gathering in Texas for a weekend of education, relaxation, and connection. In this podcast series, we take a close look at how the retreat has evolved over the last 20 years, breaking the journey down into three parts, from uniting to believing to empowering women. That is a new three-part series produced by Bloodstream Media that will be coming out right on the Bloodstream Podcast RSS feed right here. So if you are subscribed, it will be delivered directly into your podcast player of choice. If you're not subscribed to the Bloodstream Podcast, you can correct that immediately.
Shame, shame.
iTunes, shame. Game of Thrones coming soon. We are on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, all kinds of places where you can subscribe to us, and you can hear every episode delivered directly to you, and you'll get all three of those episodes next month when the Empowering Women series is launched. One other shout out for the Bloodstream Media Network. The latest episode of Ask the Expert, I talked about it last month, but it's worth repeating. The guest is Colette Koulianos from the National Hemophilia Foundation, and the topic, copay accumulator adjustment programs, which is not even easy to say. It's even more difficult to understand, but it's very important and it might be affecting you and your family. If it is, you're certainly going to want to listen to what Colette has to say about the programs and the way that NHF is trying to proactively play a role in straightening out some of the loopholes and nuances that complicate lives of our community members. It's a great episode that Amy hosts with Colette over on the Ask the Expert podcast. And as always, you can leave a rating for the Bloodstream podcast and the Ask the Expert podcast on iTunes. Those ratings do help other people find the show. So please head on over to iTunes, leave us a rating. If you aren't subscribed, as we said, please subscribe. And you can stay in touch with us on Facebook, where you'll find us at @Bloodstream Media, @Bloodstream Info on Twitter, or email us mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com.
This month's Like segment comes to us from Breaking Through, the musical and art therapy program brought to you by Believe Limited and BioMarin. You may have heard about Breaking Through's workshop and stage performance of Hemophilia the Musical last fall. And if you haven't, you're definitely going to want to check out BreakingThroughHemophilia.com to see the video. But did you know that Breaking Through might be coming to you?
What?
That's right. This year, Believe Limited and BioMarin will be executing workshops on the therapeutic value of theatrical and visual arts for teens and young people at patient organization events around the country. To find out if Breaking Through is coming to your area, contact your local patient organization leadership. And if you are patient organization leadership who would like to request a Breaking Through workshop, you can email breakingthrough@believeltd.com. Again, that's BreakingThrough@believeltd.com.
That was very impressive. That's a lot of letters very quickly. Six key questions to ask before taking part in a clinical trial and article in the latest installment of NHF's HemAware. Question number one.
Is taking part in a clinical trial right for you?
That's a great place to start. And you might need to know what a clinical trial is in order to even ask that question. And it's an important step in the development of new drugs, to be sure. Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, what is it? Tell us.
Oh, okay. Well, it's an important step in the development of new drugs. It's one of the steps that helps ensure that treatments are safe and effective before those therapies come to market and for wider use. Generally, by the time something has made it to a clinical trial, it's been studied in a lab, it's been studied in animal models, and it's now time to study it in humans. That's part of the process. So the very first question, is it right for you? And these next five questions might help you kind of drill down on that one. Question number two.
What is the purpose of the trial?
So there are different trials at different stages of a drug's development. You'll hear things like phase one, phase two, phase 2B, an extension, phase three. The later trials tend to be things like in our community where they're looking at dosing. If it's an extended half-life trial, they might be looking at the peak and trough levels with regard to different dosing measurements. Whereas in a phase one trial, they're probably just looking for the baseline safety and efficacy information. So you want to know like what exactly this trial is intended to be studying. Question three.
What are the possible risks?
So obviously, if it's a drug that's in development, that's not out yet, there's only so much we know about it. So it's important to be clear in asking what might I be getting myself into, and to understand that there's, you know, we can only know what we know. And then there's also
the known unknowns.
That's part of the process too. So it's important to ask as many questions as possible. And if you don't feel satisfied with the answers, don't hesitate to ask more than one expert. Many trials have more than, I think most, if not all trials, have multiple doctors and scientists that are involved. It's always helpful to ask questions directly of doctors and scientists who are involved, as well as to your own doctor. But don't hesitate to ask more than one of the people involved and trust your gut.
Question four. What will be asked of me during the trial?
So trials can involve tests and multiple interventions over various periods of time. So what that means is you could be asked to come back to the doctor's office or go to your clinic many times over a long period of time. You might be asked to travel to a specific location for a treatment and to stay somewhere for an extended period of time. It's important to know how often you're going to need to be where and over what length of time. Is there transportation provided or is there assistance for, are you going to have gas reimbursed or, you know, some of the practicalities of how is this trial going to impact you? It might sound really exciting, but how's it going to impact you day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year, depending on the specifications of the trial.
And who will be in charge of my care if I join the trial?
So you'll want to ask if you can keep seeing your own doctor. You want to ask if your doctor and the doctors involved in the study will be communicating back and forth to make sure that, you know, your total care and considerations are aligned. And you want to be you also want to ask if along the way you are going to be privy to progress in the trial. I think that's an important little piece that the article here points out. You know, how informed will you be kept during the course of the trial, or will you be kind of kept in the dark? And there might be good reasons. You know, they talk about trial construction. There's different reasons that trials are set up in the ways in which they are, but just ask as many questions as you can.
And the last question that the article touches upon is, what are the costs of participating in the trial?
So we talked about this with transportation just a moment ago, but there's other considerations such as, let's say you are to get injured or get sick during the participation in the trial. Is insurance going to cover those costs? If not, is there a sponsor of the trial that has agreed to cover the costs of anything that would take place during the trial? So again, asking some of those practical questions about, you know, if this is to happen, what does that mean for me? You know, jumping back one second, something I think we did not touch upon in the what will be asked of me during the trial, you might also be asked to discontinue taking any medications that for your hemophilia or for other things. So again, when asking what will be asked of you, get clarity around if you're taking other medications for anything, can you continue to take them during the trial, or are they, those considered variables that have to be eliminated? Because that might be a tipping point consideration for you as well, right?
Absolutely.
So the article is linked here in the program notes. You can also find it at hemaware.org. Within the article, there's also a link to a sample list from another organization called CenterWatch. So if you want to kind of have an opportunity to digest some other questions you might want to consider before entering a clinical trial, you can check out that list from CenterWatch. And lastly, you don't need to wait for a doctor or hematologist or anybody to present you with a trial that you might be eligible for. You can go to clinicaltrials.gov, where you can search for yourself to see what trials are available and see if there's one there that might fancy you or someone in your family, someone that you love, clinicaltrials.gov.
And once again, we'd like to thank this month's Like segment sponsor, Breaking Through. To learn more, visit breakingthroughhemophilia.com.
And now for our very first A Moment for Mental Health segment, which is brought to you this month by the Ask the Expert podcast. Did you know that mental illness, depression, and suicide prevention were topics covered by A Moment for Mental Health contributor Debbie De La Riva and former Ask the Expert host Chris Bombardier on episode 17 of the Ask the Expert, or ATE, podcast? It was a pretty open and thorough conversation about a lot of stuff we're often too scared to talk about when it comes to our mental and emotional well-being. And that's the kind of deep dive conversations with experts that you'll get on the Ask the Expert podcast, where this month, NHF's Colette Koulianos deep dives copay accumulator adjustment programs. I'm going to get really good at saying that by the end of this long name, scary subject, but really valuable information. Click the link in the program notes to listen to the Ask the Expert podcast, or search for the Ask the Expert podcast on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Welcome to A Moment for Mental Health. Mental health is a broad topic. Our goal in this segment is to break mental, emotional, and behavioral health down into its various pieces, and in each episode, to focus on just one or two of those pieces. I'm joined by Bloodstream contributor Debbie De La Riva, who is a licensed professional counselor with Mental Health Matters 2, based out of Houston, Texas. Thank you for joining us, Debbie.
Good. Thank you for having me. I am so pleased that mental health is going to be a regular segment on Bloodstream podcast. You know, the more we can just normalize the conversation, the easier people are going to have talking about it, and just healing can happen. So thank you.
Absolutely. I think so too. Our topic for this month's episode is anxiety, and it's one of the most common forms of mental unwellness. Anxiety is a word that's used a lot, but by definition, what is anxiety and what are the symptoms of anxiety?
I couldn't agree with you more. The word anxiety is used so much these days, and it really has different meanings for different people. But the thing about it is lately we seem to be putting anxiety in a real negative light. You know, when you think about it, anxiety is what we need and have always needed to do basic things like save our life. Anxiety is what propels you to get out of the way of a car that's approaching. You know, and anxiety also, it's a good thing. It motivates us to get ready for things. The whole idea, people might remember in college, that the anxiety about taking a test, well, that fear of failing is really what propelled you to study and get as prepared as you can. So it had a negative connotation, but by definition, anxiety really is a state of mind that happens when your brain perceives threats. And your brain, once triggered in this area, signals your body to get ready and to prepare itself to deal with the threat. You know, physiologically, what happens is, once again, this part of your brain is triggered. It releases adrenaline and cortisol, which is the hormone that we know triggers a fight or flight reaction. And what this does really essentially is just gets your heart rate going. It also increases your breathing rate. All of this is simply to push the blood to the muscles or parts of your body that are necessary to deal with the struggle. And the other thing is we become just so hyper-focused on either dealing with this stressor or getting it to go away. What I experience and everyone experiences when we're anxious is that our heart is just feels like it's going to pump out of our bodies, shortness of breath. People talk about how their mind races. It goes anywhere from fear to, you know, anticipating the worst that will happen in the situation. People get super sweaty, headaches, and the tight muscles that can last for a long time after the the threat's gone away.
What are some of the most common causes of anxiety and the most common risk factors in developing an anxiety disorder?
The common cause of anxiety is simply anything that we perceive as a threat. And the difference about that is that it can be a real threat, like when your life's in danger, or a perceived threat could be when you feel like you're being judged or criticized. When anxiety becomes problematic is when it is put together with all these different risk factors. One common risk factor is when someone's experienced a past trauma in their lives, they are more prone to have a problem with anxiety because basically the body has learned that bad things can happen because they have happened in your life. And when people have been in this type of trauma, they stay simply in a ready position, and they're actually scanning the environment at all times for triggers. The triggers is another word that people use a lot. Triggers are simply reminders, are evidence that bad things can happen. And they can be tricky because many times they affect us on such a subconscious level. A trigger could be something as simple as a smell that reminds you of the time that you were in a traumatic situation. It could also be a sound. Sometimes it can be a life situation where you just notice that you're in the same situation you were when whatever the trauma happened in your life. A lot of people talk about them getting sad at a certain time of year or a certain date of the month. And sometimes it's hard for people to put it together that, oh my goodness, that's when I was experiencing trauma. The second risk factor associated with anxiety is nothing less than living with a chronic condition like we are in the bleeding disorder community. And also having to deal with the acute and chronic pain. Because when you think about it, what is a common component of all of that? And that is something is happening in your body and mind that you feel like you have little control over. They've been associated, there's been multiple studies that talk about how chronic pain and depression go together too, meaning that when you're in this state of mind, you anticipate pain and you perceive it to be even higher than it actually is. And then, of course, the pain reinforces the idea that about depression and anxiety. Speaking of depression, that's another risk factor in having a hard time with anxiety in your life. Because a telltale sign of depression is this feeling that it's hopelessness, like you can't get something to take care of itself. And the other part of it is this idea about helplessness, that it's like this belief that we don't have what it takes in order to make this anxious moment go away. Another part of depression that makes it so tough to deal with anxiety is that with depression, many times people aren't thinking clearly about the world or about themselves. There's a term for it. It's called cognitive distortions. And it's when someone's depressed, they get trapped in these ways of thinking that are really hurting them instead of helping the situation. Things like all or none thinking. That could be like a mother who's had a child with hemophilia, but it also has a family history. They could think that that is how their child's life is going to be, and they can't see past it. Or obsessing on the fact that there's something defective about us, and we know it's not. But the obsession is that something's wrong, and we don't obsess about the good things about us, you know, the other parts of us, like we're funny and we're well-liked. And then catastrophizing, too, that this is only going to get worse. It's not going to get better. But when someone's super sensitive to their environment, they're also super sensitive to the threats. And so they kind of stay in a constant state of anxiety because they're finding the threats. And then the last risk factor is when you have a family history of anxiety. That's a double whammy because you've learned that is the way to deal with stress or anxiety, even if it's not good for you. And then also you share the DNA with people, with close people. And anxiety is very much rooted in your chemistry.
Debbie, how do people treat anxiety or to start to engage with some of the stuff that's happening on the inside?
Well, the first thing I want to say about that is that there's no one way to treat anxiety. Because everybody's different and, you know, they're perceiving it differently. And the best approach to dealing with anxiety or any of the stressors in your life, it's got to involve the body and the mind. Now, a lot of people know about this now, which I'm so encouraged about. But one of the most effective ways to prevent anxiety and to deal with it is this whole concept of mindfulness. And really what mindfulness is, it's just a state of mind where you're just in the present moment and you have a degree of peace about it. I mean, that really is all mindfulness is. And if I could bottle it, I'd probably make $1 million. But the way people create a mindful way of being, there's a couple of techniques people can do, but they all involve a couple of components. And one of them is breathing and just focusing on your breath. And it does two things. Number one, it takes your mind off whatever it is you're stressed out about or anxious about. And number two, when you can breathe at a constant rate and a rate where you're in control, it actually triggers your mind to release endorphins and all kinds of other things that just help your body to relax. You know, people talk about being mindful as having like an intentional focus. And that's true, but the focus is on things that bring you peace. You can visualize being in your favorite spot or being in a time in your life, know that you're completely at peace. A lot of people combine this with using that time just to say good things about themselves, affirmation, or letting them know that they're going to be okay, even though there's problems happening in their life. So I hope I've broadened people's ideas of the image of mindfulness is not just someone sitting in a position and humming chants. It's really just about calming your body and your mind and getting into a good place.
Final question for today. Are there medications to treat anxiety?
Oh, yes. There is an array of them. The names are lorazepam and Xanax. A lot of people have heard about these. A lot of medication for depression also helps with anxiety. And that's things like Celexa and Wellbutrin and Prozac are some of the common ones. I would like to say two things about it. Number one, that's a decision that you need to make with a trusted medical profession or a psychiatrist. And also the other thing about it that people don't realize is it takes a long time for these medications to get to this therapeutic value where it actually makes a difference in your body. And a lot of people get frustrated and quit, but it's important to hang in there and to never stop fighting and never stop trying different medications. I noticed, too, that you're going to probably have some segments on other ways of dealing with anxiety. And real common trend right now in psychotherapy is something called cognitive behavioral therapy. And I know you're going to talk more about it on another broadcast, but it's the most effective way to deal with anxiety and depression. You basically sit with a therapist that helps you identify and challenge all of these thoughts that you're having that are creating more strife in your body and more strife and stress. What it does is it kind of forces you to look at messages you might have gotten about yourself as you're growing up that are making you anxious, things like I'm not good enough, you know, are messages that you might have about the world, like, okay, this is a really unsafe place. And so cognitive, just being aware of your thoughts and challenging them and being more in control is super effective. So I'm really excited you guys are going to dive more in depth about that in future podcasts.
Well, you are right. I think that sounds like a great topic for next month's episode. Debbie, we're out of time for today, but where can listeners who experience anxiety go to learn more about prevention and management of anxiety and some of that restlessness that they feel inside?
Yeah, there's so many ways of finding out information. So I like the opportunity to try to help people home in on the ones that are respected by everyone and recognized as the experts. And one particular website, it's Mental Health America. So it's www.mentalhealthamerica.net. Not only does it have information on a variety of mental health conditions, but what it also does, it has a tool on it so that you can actually have a mental health screening in the comfort of your own home. It's confidential. It's online. And what it does is ask you a series of questions that could indicate whether you're prone to having a problem with anxiety or mood disorder. And it's super helpful. So thank you for the opportunity to tell people about it.
Absolutely. Thank you again, Debbie. And I am so looking forward to our conversation next month. I think this is so important and I can't thank you enough.
Good. Thank you so much.
We once again want to thank the A Moment for Mental Health segment sponsor, the Ask the Expert podcast, where you can hear expert interviews on the topics that matter most. Visit bloodstreamexpert.com or search for the Ask the Expert podcast on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And a reminder that the presenting sponsor of the Bloodstream podcast this month and every month, as always, is Takeda. And for that, we say, thanks, Takeda. This month's share segment comes to us from community member Jonathan Hill in a piece that he has titled The Long Road.
My name's Jonathan Hill, and this is my share segment entitled The Long Road. I am 49 years old, and I was born with severe hemophilia. Factor was a new product when I was diagnosed in 1971. I have had the benefit of access to Factor Concentrate my whole life, but I also experienced the dark side of Factor. I was exposed to both HIV and HCV viruses in the 1980s. My HIV virus remains well managed. HCV was my Achilles heel. I eventually received treatment for the disease around 2007, but the liver damage was done. In 2008, I suffered a severe varices rupture and nearly lost my life. It was clear that my liver disease had worsened and I needed a transplant. I started going to a liver transplant center and was added to donor recipients' wait lists. I spent 10 years waiting as my condition slowly declined. Many transplant patients die waiting for an available organ. So many people are waiting for so few donor organs. I did everything I could. I shared my story with my friends, eventually publicly on social media, talking to researchers about various studies and programs that might increase my chances of getting a new organ, and even changed my care to a larger transplant center. The summer of 2017 was the low point. I kept passing out due to lack of oxygen, and I was on so many painkillers, my mind was starting to go numb. There were ambulances at our house almost weekly, taking me back to the hospital time and time again. It was widely thought I only had a few months left, and it was becoming likely I would not be strong enough to survive a transplant. Then I discovered a new research program at Northwestern Medicine specific to my condition. We went to meet the team. I had another mental break, what caused by toxicity in my blood, and I was admitted to the hospital. While in the hospital, it was determined I had developed hepopulmonary syndrome, which is a shortness of breath and hypoxia, low oxygen levels in the blood, caused by broadening of the blood vessels in the lungs of patients with liver disease. My liver was causing me to suffocate. I had been passing out for months with continually documented low oxygen levels at the hospitals. It took a hepatologist at Northwestern Medicine to connect the dots. This diagnosis ultimately jumped me to the top of the recipient wait list. In a period of 2 months, I received 4 possible organ calls, and the final one was the match. On October 27th, 2017, I received a liver transplant. It has been a little over a year since I received my transplant. As a result, I no longer have hemophilia, which is really weird. Factor VIII protein is produced, for the most part, in the liver. So, with a new liver from a donor that did not have hemophilia, my body started producing normal factor VIII levels. It has been an amazing journey. I am grateful for this new chapter in my life. I could not have made it to this moment without the love, support, and prayers from my friends and family. I'd especially like to highlight the important role the hemophilia treatment centers have played in my journey. Throughout my life, HTCs have taught me to understand accept, and advocate for my bleeding disorder, and ultimately for all of my medical conditions. As my liver disease advanced, my HTC helped me work with my insurance company to ensure I had access to a liver transplant program with experience in hemophilia transplants. They continually worked with various hospitals and emergency rooms where I was being treated to ensure that my hemophilia was treated first in any medical situation or emergency. They were always there for any medical question and were emotionally invested in my journey. When it was time for my transplant, they worked directly with my transplant team to create a surgery plan to prevent bleeding during and after the surgery. In closing, to anyone struggling with a major medical challenge, the biggest piece of advice I can give you is learn all you can about your condition. Take charge of your medical care. Be your own medical advocate. Build a strong medical team and support network around you. And finally, live your life. This was a lesson my father instilled in me back when AIDS entered my life. I wanted to give up and stop going to school. He said, keep going and follow your passion. During those scary times, I still earned my AA, BA, and MA degrees. This was one of the best decisions in my life.
The Episode 34 Share segment was brought to you by Stop the Bleeding, winner of the 2018 LA Web Fest's Award for Best Comedic Premise and nominated for a Norman Lear Imogen Award. Stop the Bleeding is a comedic and educational web series that uses humor to teach and stories to inspire people affected by bleeding disorders. From the importance of advocacy and prophylaxis to the effect of bleeding disorders on sibling and family members, if it's a topic of importance to the bleeder community, chances are Stop the Bleeding has it covered. Visit stbhemo.com, where you can watch all 8 seasons of the award-winning comedy series for free. That's stbhemo.com, or check out stbhemo on Instagram for bite-sized videos, memes, and other show-related content.
This month's interview segment is with Dr. Glenn Pierce of the World Federation of Hemophilia, who's going to give us some insights into the inner workings of the WFH and some updates on what's going on over there. What's going on with you guys? But before we get to that, I have to let you know that this month's interview segment is brought to you by the Teen Impact Awards, held annually on the opening night of National Hemophilia Foundation's Bleeding Disorders Conference and now entering its 5th year. The Teen Impact Awards honors leaders of the future by recognizing teens affected by bleeding disorders who are making a positive impact in their homes, schools, and communities. To watch video from last year's show featuring guest presenters such as NHF's Nicole Scappi, NFL Super Bowl champion Josh Gordy, and Save One Life's Chris Bombardier, as well as many others, or to learn more about nominations for this year's program. They're starting very soon, actually. They're starting in May. Head on over to teenimpactawards.com. That's teenimpactawards.com, or you can find the Teen Impact Awards on Facebook and on Instagram. And thanks, as always, to the founding sponsor of the Teen Impact Awards, Takeda. All right, so I am joined now by Robert C. Cooper. Hello, Rob.
Hi.
We're here specifically because of his new series, Unspeakable, which is an 8-episode drama that he has created and wrote and directed many of the episodes for. It premiered on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation on January 9th. It's based on the books Bad Blood by Vic Parsons and The Gift of Death, or I should say it's adapted from, I suppose, we can get into that, by Andre Picard. And it chronicles the emergence of HIV, AIDS, and hepatitis C in the Canadian Red Cross's blood banks in the early 1980s. For a little bit of background on Robert, he served as the showrunner on Holistic Detective, a holistic detective agency.
Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. It's a very long title. I don't blame you for dropping some of it.
Fair enough. Dick Gently's Holistic
Detective. Dirk.
Oh my goodness. It's a good thing you're here. For BBC America, Netflix, and AMC Studios. He was the showrunner for the record-breaking Stargate television franchise for MGM and co-created Stargate Atlantis and Stargate Universe. Served as executive producer, writer, and director of multiple episodes of all 3 series and 2 movies. movies. All told, and this is an astonishing number, the worldwide hit spanned 14 years and produced over 360 hours. That is a lot of content.
I have very little memory of most of it.
Just be in the trenches for it. Robert's been nominated and won several awards for both writing and directing, including two Hugo nominations and a Canadian Writers Guild Award for Best Dramatic Screenplay. In 2009, he was presented with an Outstanding Achievement Award for contribution to the British Columbia television industry. And he now considers The Green Light for Unspeakable a lifelong dream project, the highlight of his career. All right, that is an impressive resume that has led to the highlight of your career, huh?
I've said this before, maybe not to your audience, but I feel like I'm repeating myself. The fact is, you know, they always teach you write what you know. I wish I didn't know this story, but I certainly hope I will never write something this obviously tragic, but also this personal. You know, when it was over, I was watching the finished episodes with my family, and I expressed how strange it felt to finally have it done, because it's been a long time, not only in the writing and making, but in the living.
Yeah.
I said, this is weird. I just don't think I'll ever have an experience like this again in my life. And my 17-year-old daughter said, you know, you're 50. It's okay if you've peaked.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So I mean, that's the beauty of children. They keep you grounded. They don't care about the resume.
No, they don't. No, nor the filter. Take us through a bit of that. I should also mention, so we've said it before in the podcast, we'll say it again, the show is premiering next month in April here in the US, as well on Sundance TV. So take us through a little bit of that process. You know, because of what I do, I'm particularly interested in sort of the creative development and production process and what that was like. But for our audience to be able to appreciate, you know, it doesn't start the first day that you get into a writer's room. It starts long before for the creator. So what was the true start of this process for you?
I spent the vast majority of my formative years not talking about the fact that I had hemophilia or Hep C, and you know, largely due to the stigma of AIDS and the prejudice that was being directed at all of the high-risk communities. You didn't wear your Medic Alert bracelet. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a bit in the show about people asking the Hemophilia Society to send out the mailers in brown paper. Psychologically, over a great long period of time, that really, you know, becomes ingrained. And so your instinct is to not talk about it.
Right.
So the show, in some ways, in terms of my own experience, I don't want to say it minimizes it, but it certainly doesn't go quite as far as the reality was. And in 2014, when I was finally cured of Hep C, I began to sort of think about the story a little more from the point of view of a storyteller than as a victim. When you're a victim, at least for me, one of the coping mechanisms, which I guess I was pretty good at, was denial. You just literally didn't admit what was going on or the gravity of it. Mm-hmm. And if I was forced to talk about it or testify about it, that would put it right there in my face.
Right.
And you know, that's a little bit selfish, I realize, because part of the reason compensation happened and part of the reason change happened and a certain amount of positive impact on community came from people sharing, which is certainly part of the point of the show. Mm-hmm. But maybe a little bit of my restitution towards the community in trying to pay tribute to the people who lived through this. The opportunity came up at CBC, who I was in business with on another project. I was talking to the executive I dealt with on a day-to-day basis and said, you know, have you guys ever done anything about the blood scandal? CBC, for those who don't know down here, is a public broadcaster. It's good, you know, partially or at least almost entirely government owned. Anyway, they, it turns out, had not ever entertained, I was surprised, had not ever developed or entertained doing a story on this. And they came back and they said, yeah, look, you know, given your personal connection to it, we'd love to hear what you what you want to do.
And they were pretty quickly agreeable to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, again, not to bring up the resume, but, you know, they and again, we were trying to find something to do. Like they wanted to work with me.
Right, right. So you have good leverage there between the resume and their desire to work with you. It gives you an opportunity to pitch something that might otherwise be challenging to get a yes on.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's always the, in just getting back to the business and how it works. I mean, there from a buyer's perspective, you have a couple things you have to weigh. And one is we like the idea. That's first and foremost. But then the biggest step after that is the execution of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, are we buying into the human beings who are going to actually fulfill that expectation? So what I did was immediately write this long stream of consciousness rant, basically. It was not a traditional television creative pitch where I explained what the show was going to actually be about or the characters or what the plot was going to be. And so when I pitched something that had this much personal passion behind it, everybody responded to it. And so from that point, they greenlit the writing of two scripts and enough money to put together what we call a room, which is four walls and a, you know, floor and a ceiling, but also some people to go in. That,
right, the people inside, part is what
in
makes
that
it unique.
Space.
And is that because you had three other writers and then three other directors other than yourself involved in the show? Who all was in that room? Who comes in at that point in the process?
Well, actually, they were different writers than, with the one exception, there's a woman named Adriana Capazzi who was with me from the beginning. She's one of the first phone calls I ended up making. I didn't even know her at the time. She was had just given birth to her second child. Our agent introduced us, and I said, "Well, obviously you have a lot of time on your hands." I said, you know, do you want to jump in and do some research on this project with me? And she read the books and she was like, I don't believe this. I can't believe this happened. And that's been, you know, the reaction we've gotten from the get-go. There's a guy named Peter Mansbridge who hosted the National in Canada, which was kind of like the NBC nightly news or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah, he's at these seminal moments. We show what was being said. Adriana and I did a good 6 months of research. I knew a number of folks who were directly connected through the Canadian Society, but they, you know, introduced me to other people, and, you know, one, you know, person leads to another.
Right.
So we did copious interviews.
So did you know then at this time that it was going to be 8 episodes, 5+ hours of content, or where was the thinking there?
We were overwhelmed by how much there was. We didn't know how we were going to pare it down. Like there was so much. And every time we had a conversation, there was something new that came up. The max for what networks seemed to be willing to digest in a limited series form was 8 episodes. There was along the way quite a back and forth about paring it down to 6. And I fought that because I really felt like the story needed 8 to really not just tell all the beats, but let the characters breathe. Because to me, the reason to do this as a drama and not a documentary was to engage people emotionally in the story. That's what would give the story, the bigger overarching story, the historical fact, meaning, like make it mean something to
you. And I have to say, so I'm 5 of the 8 episodes into the show, and I have been impressed, and I said this to you in an email, like it's, you don't waste time. It starts and boom, we're in it. But there's a nice balance between a really well-paced narrative and time so that we appreciate all the different families and couples and individuals that we meet and how they are affected and can appreciate all the different manifestations of what it meant to be affected by this. I appreciate that that is pared down from so much more.
There were so many characters, so many people, and yet we had also really pared it down from the reality into these composites, right?
Mm-hmm.
There were people who represent a whole swath of the kind of people who were affected, right?
Right.
And so you had, you know, you had the medical side of it. You had nurses and doctors, and then you had the victims, but you had primary hemophiliacs who were affected. You had people in other high-risk groups who were affected. You had secondary infections, wives who were affected. So we looked at all of the, I think, key character types and tried to represent those and took real people, real experiences, and, you know, melded them into sort of one uber character that would somehow hopefully represent that properly. You are kind of hit with a lot of information initially, but once you settle in, hopefully what's carrying you are the stories of the primary families and, mm-hmm. and then the supporting group around them that end up fighting for compensation, and the doctors who were at the forefront of treatment and testing and then the people who, you know, on the legal side ended up affecting things so greatly in terms of compensation, because people who aren't familiar with the Canadian story, there was a federal inquiry that took the better part of 4 years and resulted in a major document that reshaped the blood system in Canada, and in fact has been used as a template for other blood systems around the world. Hmm. So sort of it is famously, in our country anyway, known as the Creever Report, because Horace Creever was the judge who presided over the inquiry. In a way, the bigger the problem, the harder it is to get people to feel empathy for it. So for example, you have a country, a people starving in some far off place, and you're asking for donations, you're much better off introducing one person, one poor little girl who's starving,
right,
and telling her story. You'll get way more response than if you say, oh, and by the way, there are 500,000 other people like her also starving, and we desperately need your money. That's, for some reason, it just turns off a switch in people and they can't relate to it. Here's the thing. We marvel at facts, but we are emotionally compelled by story. That's the problem of tragedies like this and the scope. And you can say, oh, you know, this many people died, and everybody goes, oh my God, but are they going to do anything about it? But if your neighbor is fallen ill, you're going to do everything you can to help them.
Well, you know, it's a little bit of a sidebar, but I mentioned to you that I'm working with Jeannie White on stories and work related to her and Ryan White's experience. And in uncovering people working for Senator Ted Kennedy when he was formulating what became the Ryan White Care Act, it was my partner and I did research and learned all the interesting twists and turns, not all, but many of the interesting twists and turns that primarily these two individuals working under Kennedy took in trying to figure out how to garner the necessary bipartisan support to get a piece of federal legislation through a very split Senate, and ultimately decided they needed the young, innocent face of Ryan White, even if it meant there were going to be others in the activist community who felt as though, well, putting that face on it is only going to make it easier to split us into the different groups of the innocent victims and the everybody else, and you deserve it, and you brought this upon yourself, people. But it's that one story. The legislation needed that one story.
Yeah, and you know, in my position, can't help but feel a certain... You know, you walk a line where you don't want it to appear as though you're in any way exploiting what happened to that person in trying to tell that story.
Right.
That there's a reason for dramatizing this in the way that we did. In that case, there was obviously a bigger political goal and an end game that was well worth this strategy. Kind of circling back to the process, I had walked into that room with two of the stories already kind of fleshed out, based upon a very detailed, extensive timeline that Adriana deserves full credit for having pulled together. So we had these two books. One was called Gift of Death by Andre Picard, who was a health editor and writer, a journalist, a writer for the Globe and Mail, a big newspaper up in Canada. Mm. And a guy named Vic Parsons, his book was originally called Bad Blood and now has been retitled Bad Blood, The Unspeakable Truth to tie into the show.
Uh-huh.
It's actually been republished and is available on Amazon for anyone who's interested. you know, those two books, plus all the interviews we did, plus the actual Creever report, which is available online. We also pulled over 60,000 pages of testimony from the actual inquiry so we could hear people's voices.
Wow.
In their own words. Out of total necessity, the only way to really do it was to try and attack it in a linear fashion at first, to say, okay, here are the beats as they happened and when they happened. So we could use that as a backbone. This happened on this day, and this is a seminal moment that we absolutely cannot not include.
Mm-hmm.
So we wrote that document, and then we ended up like whittling that down to a lean 60 pages when we went into the room, and then started to kind of pull out, how do these facts then impact or relate, or how do we dramatize those from the perspective of our characters and who our lead characters were. So I had already sort of figured out who the key people were. And so we ended up with documents, like 1 to 2 page documents for each episode, that formed our sort of more detailed pitch to the network. We, you know, waited for word. And at the same time, I was writing and producing on Dirk for AMC Studios and BBC America, and had developed a good relationship with them. And they knew this was a passion project of mine and that CBC was going to pick it up. And they came in on the international distribution, and obviously U.S. domestic with Sundance. So that's kind of how the financing pulled together. There was a calendar on how shows work in Canada, depending on the public funding. So there's tax credits and funds you access to get money for production, and those tend to work on these fiscal years. So we actually had to push 1 year. And by this time, we were now 2 years from that initial room. We pulled a slightly different group together. Carl Binder, who is someone I worked with on Stargate. He was a showrunner in his own right. And I knew, because I was taking on a lot, being sort of the Canadian studio entity, as well as the writer, director, you know, producer, I needed someone else to really be my right hand practically, and who could, you know, be in meetings when I was on set or vice versa.
Right.
One of the things we did, which was unusual, is we shot the first 4 episodes together as one block. So you're kind of shooting scenes from all those 4 episodes, perhaps in one day. That was driven partly by location and partly because of the nature of the show, which is that it starts in 1982 and slowly, in some cases very quickly, moves through time. It ends in the last episode in 2015. So that's a big span.
Yeah.
But it also meant we were, production-wise, dealing with, you know, different times.
Yeah, it's a period eras. Piece on top of a period piece on top of a period
piece.
Yeah,
it was not one period piece.
Right.
It was like 6 period pieces. And that's incredibly challenging.
Yeah.
It's a consideration in every respect. You have hair, makeup, wardrobe, set deck, you know, locations, cars, everything has to, you know, be right.
And right.
So we also looked at it and said, how do we compartmentalize the period aspects so that when we're in this house or in this location, it's 1982 to 1986.
Had you ever worked on anything that had this many, from a period standpoint, that many variables to consider?
No. I mean, you know, Stargate was so many different things. You know, you had alien worlds and fantasy and monsters and creatures. And so there was no real logistical problem that I hadn't really experienced before. Like that show really prepared me for just about anything. The thing about production is it seems overwhelming when you're starting, when you're first looking at the whole thing. You're saying, oh my God, I've got so much to worry about and do. But really what happens is you end up starting to break it down and break it down and break it down until it's in its barest minimum finite. What do I have to do this hour? Once you've broken it down into its absolute, every detail should be on that call sheet every day so that everybody knows what's going on and where everybody needs to be. It's not that hard.
Yeah.
Like that.
Then you just got to go do it.
Then you just got to go do it. Learning that is a process. And when you've had some experience and been through it, you learn not to panic.
Right, right.
That, when you see the tidal wave coming at you.
Right, know? And that's the trick, right? It's not that you like know how to do it. You know not to panic when it seems as though the tidal wave is coming and this is imminent
because you
doom.
Know it looks bad from a distance, but really when you get closer, it's actually a whole bunch of little waves one at a time, and you just have to take them that way.
One at a time. Was there a particularly painful compromise or that you had to make along the way?
Oh, I mean, that honestly happens every minute. And again, it's just something you kind of learn to live with. It's like, you know, this is what I have, and this is what I have to work with. And it's not that I don't see it in the final product. It's just, nothing I could do about it. I think there are scenes that are really hurt by not having enough extras, but it's not just the human beings that are expensive. It's the wardrobe when you're doing period. It's there's a lot of things that go into that. And so, you'll see other shows that are bigger budget shows and there's hundreds of people wandering around.
Right.
as part of the set deck and dressing. And we just didn't have the money to do that. And I do think you feel that sometimes. You feel like, well, where are all the people? When you actually look at the real footage, so we had a lot of actual coverage from the news and from just online video. And a lot of what went on outside of the people's homes took place in these sort of white-walled low rent offices.
Right, right.
But even the institutions, looked kind of crappy. And so we embraced that, mm-hmm. We were like, look, let's play into that reality. And unfortunately, some of these decisions take place in just a run of the mill office.
Yeah. Not particularly aesthetically interesting.
No.
Just a boring all office.
Exactly. And so, in fact, I think the expectation is that it's going to be this big, opulent, rich looking thing. But, we kind of went with what was real.
It's funny. This just came to mind. Matthew Weiner, in talking about Mad Men in the final episode of that, spoiler alert, there's three pivotal conversations that the primary character, Don, has with the three women of his life, so to speak. And they're all on the phone. And there was an interview with him where he was asked about that. And he said, for all of the drama, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, but basically for all of the drama that you sometimes write into a show, so many of the most impactful, most important conversations of my life have been over the phone, because especially if we think before the age of cell phones and FaceTime and video things, you picked up, if it was urgent, you picked up a phone and you called the person because it was urgent.
Sure.
And so I wanted to stay true to that. And I thought, that's such a mature choice. And I, as a viewer, didn't feel like, man, I really wish that last conversation with Peggy was like, they were looking at each other and doing, I actually appreciated the distance. And there was an interesting nuance to the performances, I think, because they couldn't be in the same room. So it's a different way of like, use the reality of a circumstance, even if it's not necessarily the most dramatic or elevated.
Sexy way of doing it. Yeah. We faced that too, because and I think it was more less of a detraction and more of a feature that one of the reasons this happened was a lack of communication. People were isolated, and people felt alone in their homes, and there was no instantaneous way of tweeting out a problem and having the larger community jump in and support you. Mm-hmm. This was a lack of information that was the problem, a lack of communication from the powers that be and the people who needed to band together. And so, we wanted to make it obvious that people were using faxes, and that, the character Will at one point goes to see, a government representative and is like, this has to change now. And the guy says to him, well, bring it up at the next meeting. And Will's like, that's 3 months from now. There were quarterly meetings. And he's like, people are dying now. This is not something that can wait for a meeting. So it was a feature of the reason why this whole thing kind of transpired. And we wanted to demonstrate that as well. Is there's a big scene where Will's kind of pacing around on the phone trying to get some stuff done for similar reasons. I mean, it was a dial-up rotary phone with a big, long, twirly cord. You know?
Right, right. Every group, by the way, needs a Will. Everybody needs a Will who just like doesn't care and is just cutting through the BS and speaking truth to power. Will's great.
He's very closely based on, inspired by a guy named Bill Mindell, who was worked for public health in Toronto and was the father of a hemophiliac and the primary a whistleblower and sort of consumer advocate, pain in the ass to the Red Cross, and is, in my estimation, one of the true heroes of the story and deserves, you know, way more credit than I think the real person ever got.
Were there moments of, you know, I was intrigued kind of going back to the beginning of our conversation when you were talking about the people, in, even in your family and, you know, just a degree removed from your most intimate people who didn't know. And I'm curious, have you been surprised or did you anticipate the amount of personal response and personal, both from people who are seeing it and had something they wanted to say to you about their experience, and then also just your own response to the material as it was being developed and created and acted and edited and composed into a final product? Were you moved in ways you didn't expect?
Any of the times that the scenes or the dialogue was directly ripped from my own life or experience, I found it pretty bizarre. Like there was almost like a surreal quality to watching actors act a scene that happened to you. Or
yeah,
that was weird. I don't really know how else to put that. But, you know, where I got affected most was by some of the stories that other people told me about their experience. Because look, I am, as much as I dealt with, I'm an outlier in that I'm very lucky to be here telling this story. There were, you know, 90% of the kids in my clinic didn't make it. So I never forget that in the process. And then, you know, you just hear unbelievable, devastating stories about people who lost not just one person, but, you know, many people. It's a genetic disorder. So some of these people had two kids with hemophilia or and a brother and an uncle, and all of them died. And right. So as we were doing the research, I was stunned by what I was learning. Like, are you kidding me? But then you kind of as a writer have to, we don't have to, but I guess I did try and take as much, not objective, but to separate myself so that I could understand all the elements of the story and look at the folks inside the institutions and the decisions that were made and try and figure out why that happened. And, you know, as opposed to that first emotional rant that I wrote, you know, how to actually tell this story properly and be fair and also within the legal bounds of liability, you know, and not to say we were in any way dishonest, but you in fact, it makes you scrutinize things much more harshly.
Sure. The Alien show, you probably didn't have to do that for Stargate. You know?
No, I mean, we did have the Air Force was, you know, occasionally telling us they wouldn't do that. And I said, wouldn't do that when the aliens attack? and they'd be like, yes, that's right. That would not be our alien protocol. We were sort of like officially sanctioned by the Air Force. So they actually read all our scripts and
wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Anyway, I mean, I guess watching the show when it was finally done, there was an experience of, you know, the totality of everything that went into it. That's always the case with any project. And I don't think any viewer, and I don't have any expectation that any viewer will ever appreciate what it takes to make a show. Cause, you know, in most cases you watch it and digest it and that was great. What's next?
Right, right. At best, right? At best, that's what we hope.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. What's next?
Yeah. So the experience of making it has to also be rewarding. That has to be the thing we get our gratification from. And in this case, there was so much passion and love from everyone involved in it, that it was just a great experience. I mean, again, I use the word great.
Right. Written, yeah.
With respect to the subject matter we were dealing with. It was, you know, it was as sort of human an experience as you could hope for, the connections and the support. And, that part of it was, you know, made all the other hard part more than worthwhile.
Curious to know a little bit about the reception, to the degree to which you're paying attention to the reception in Canada. What has it been?
I think what I value most is the sort of very personal, direct messages that I've been getting. Like that, that means, you know, more than anything. I think that we live in an age where the consumption of television and the consumption of stories in general is in such flux and is changing so much that you look at it and you go, okay, I'm putting something out there that hopefully is going to live for a good long time. And in a way, this story is kind of timeless because it is a period piece that looks back. You know, people are in a mood now where they feel like the world is, you know, rough and bad stuff's going on, and I just want a little entertainment at the end of my day. We want something else. We want escapism, and this is not that. And
no.
I'm not going to try and sell it as anything.
But it is entertaining. It is entertainment. It's not escapism, but it is entertainment.
I sort of look at it from my own experience as a viewer, what I seek out. And when I'm looking for a show to watch, I want, in a way, something that makes me feel like I have participated in the shared human experience in a way that I haven't before. In general, the response, one of the responses I've gotten is, I think when we talk about the subject matter, people do imagine something very depressing and sad. And you know, as tough as the show is and doesn't look away from the harsher aspects of what went on, it does invoke emotions other than just sad, depressing people dying all the time.
This is true.
It makes you angry. It inspires you. I think in the greatest... my greatest hope for the show is that it would actually motivate you to action, to want to be more proactive in your own life, in standing up for what you believe in or fighting for a cause that you think is important, and demonstrating that things can change or that positive results can come from bad situations, and that you know, there may be someone else out there who needs you to reach out to them, to help them through a tough time. And that you, by taking that action and standing up and doing something, you can actually affect them, an individual, in a positive way. And all of that is good. I mean, all of that can make you feel good.
You know, the point you made too about motivating individuals to action reminds me of the conversation about the dull office spaces where important decisions are made. I think we can think that, and I know I grew up with an idea that, like, oh, other people are taking care of things, you know? And as a kid, like, yeah, largely, like, you're not, like, adults in the world are, but it was this, like, nameless, faceless group of who knows who were doing the important stuff. And as I've grown up, I've realized, oh, it's all just individuals. It's individuals making choices. That's how literally everything happens. Sometimes it's a group of more individuals than fewer individuals, but it's ultimately a bunch of people just deciding stuff.
Corporations are people.
Well, that gets into a whole other thing. Yeah. But that, you know, that activism and creating a change, it can sound like scary and amorphous, but it is. It is the characters in this story. It's Will, who are individuals making that decision.
Yeah, and, like, you know, we face this all the time in talking about, you know, what makes people go out and vote, or what makes this feeling of helplessness or hopelessness, and that, oh, what's the point of going to some rally? People don't notice me, or I'm not making a difference. But for me, again, what it comes back to is the direct individual who emails or calls and says, thank you for doing this. You know, this was incredibly special to me.
So I should bring the info back in front of me here. So it will premiere, and it's premiering as a 2-night event. So is it the four episodes? Is that how the structure?
No, it's episode 1 on the 4th, episode 2 on the 5th, and then the following week will be it basically every Thursday, Friday.
It's following that structure.
Yeah, so it'll be episode 3 and 4 on the next week, and so 4 weeks in a row, it'll sort of air all 8 episodes.
I like that actually. That's a neat, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like rhythmically. Yeah. And I think too, for this show in the first 2 episodes and the way that they table set everything, that's kind of a nice way to ingest it, is like 1, 2, little pause, 3, 4, little yeah. pause.
And you know, obviously, immediately available on Sundance Now there. And I think it's even on AMC on demand. It'll be sort of, whatever your service is that allows you to look at things on demand, it'll be available there, and on iTunes if you choose to pay for it.
And is there other, when you'd mentioned the international rights, and obviously for a show that's created in Canada, that includes the United States, but are there other premieres, and is it launching in other places?
It will be available everywhere in the world. We've certainly had a lot of people online asking, when do I get it in Italy? When do I get it in Australia? Yes, the answer is yes, it will be. I don't have dates yet though. And we'll hopefully do a good job of broadcasting those announcements when they happen.
So you're here now, and then just as kind of, I guess, a closing thought, what happens after this week in Los Angeles? I imagine you'll still be doing what you can to promote the show as it's being released. But then there's probably other things that your life turns toward, I imagine.
Yeah, you know, you move on to find some other story to tell. It's kind of the reason we get into this business. We're always looking for something kind of fresh and exciting and different and challenging. I mean, this was definitely, and I had sort of reached a point in my career where, you know, aside from deciding to tell a personal story, you look for things that kind of scare you a little. 'Cause that energy is what, I guess, makes you feel alive. I'm not going to go scale the side of a cliff without, you know, a rope or net.
Yeah, free soloing isn't your future.
No, not really. But I do understand that thrill seeking
sort
of thing. And I think it's, you know, I don't know how common it is, but I have heard that there is a little bit of that wanting to push yourself and this is obviously not physical, this was intellectual, but as a hemophiliac, you're always kind of looking for those boundaries and looking and you almost feel in some ways like you're being told, I can't do this or I can't do that. So you push back against that. And so I think there is a little bit of thrill seeker that gets, you know, woven into you.
That resonates with me completely. Well, thank you for coming on. We'll have all the appropriate links in the program notes. We're going to do what we can to help with promoting the show as much as possible within the U.S. And as it rolls out in other places, we'll keep an eye on the social media accounts and share what we can to just kind of help that reverberation.
Please, yeah. I mean, if nothing else, just go online and tell other people to watch.
We will. Just on a personal note, I admire the courage that I can only imagine it took to make the decision to do this, and in doing so, to talk about your health and in a way that you never have before.
Yeah, and I'll just sort of end with this little story that kind of goes along with the beginning of what we started to talk about, which is that back after that first bit of development got announced, and it was like CBC was picking up the show. Mm-hmm. They did a story on me, and this is the first time they had sort of publicly connected the creator and his own story to the project. And my mom called me, and of course she kind of knew this was all happening. It wasn't a big surprise, but she called to say, you know, obviously, congratulations and I'm proud of you and everything. But then she says, but why did you tell them about yourself? And I was like, Mom, that's the selling feature.
Right.
That's what made people so excited about this you know, that felt that it was, you know, I was uniquely qualified to sort of tell this story. But I think that's indicative of that mentality that still had not, she had not overcome, and that I had sort of, you know, kind of jumped that shark, so to speak.
Yeah, that's a very telling moment. That's a very telling moment.
Anyway, thank you very much for doing this. Appreciate what you do with the podcast. It's definitely needed and
could have used it 30 years ago, right?
Yes,
could have used one.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Moving into this month's comment segment on drugs that cost as much as a house.
Whoa.
Devastating effects that can have. But, you know, before we get to that, Natalie, did you want to say something?
I wanted to say that today's comment segment is brought to us by the Von Willebrand disease series from Bloodborne.
Oh, okay.
Created from over 25 interviews with patients, clinicians, family members, and advocates from all across the world. Mm-hmm. Bloodline's VWD series is a 3-episode podcast documentary.
How many episodes is it?
3.
Okay.
That explores the simple yet surprisingly complex question, what does it mean to live with VWD? You can stream part 1, Diagnosis and Management, under the Episodes tab on thebloodlinepod.com or search the Bloodline Podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or
wherever you listen to podcasts.
That's my line.
Well, I got excited and had to jump in.
Okay, he's always doing that.
All right, moving into this month's comment segment, drugs that cost as much as a house are on the way to treat rare and devastating diseases. The U.S. is scrambling to figure out how to pay for them. A recent article from Business Insider. So I'm going to kind of jump around different points made in the article in the interest of kind of synthesizing things here. In late 2017, the Food and Drug Administration gave the go-ahead to the first gene therapy approved for inherited disease in the U.S., a drug called Luxturna, which is specifically used to treat a rare form of blindness. That one-time treatment has kind of a high price tag, $425,000 per eye to be exact. Now, despite that cost, Luxturna itself hasn't challenged our healthcare system because it's only eligible to about 1 to 2,000 people total, a relatively small population size. And as Dr. Michael Sherman, who is the chief medical officer for the nonprofit health insurer Harvard Pilgrim, points out, it's not a problem if you've only got a few of these. It's a problem if you've got a lot of these, and it's a problem if they're charging a high price. The article goes on to talk about the pharma giants, as they call them, that are essentially in an arms race to get involved in this emerging and potentially very lucrative gene therapy space. And while there's only one drug the first was only approved in late 2017, the FDA is expecting to approve 10 to 20 new gene therapies each year by 2025. So it is a very rapidly growing space. And as Dr. Sherman again points out, the problem is that, you know, we call these rare diseases, but collectively they're not all that rare. So when you start putting them all together, you end up with significant expenses. It's worth pointing out Luxturna is made by Spark, who we might be familiar with in this community for their work in hemophilia, and who we may also be familiar with for being recently acquired by Roche, who we should also be familiar with for their work in hemophilia, specifically Hemlibra. And it's not coincidence that both Roche and Spark are operating in the hemophilia space. And as the article points out, hemophilia comes up a lot in conversation with gene therapy because it's a population affecting 20 to 25,000 people. And as we have gene therapies that are made available for populations of 20 to 25,000 people, that's a significantly bigger toll on the health system than a drug that's available for, say, 1 to 2,000 people. Unfortunately, we are not set up to figure out how to pay for these kind of drugs. We're already the country that has the highest cost for prescription medication of any in the world. And now, as Leora Schiff, a principal at Atlas Strategy Consulting, which works with biopharmaceutical and other healthcare companies, points out, insurers are now considering what to cover. And they might consider that the more expensive a drug is, the more likely it might get limited to those patients who are the sickest. There are consortiums coming together and putting the right players around the table, or at least the hopes that they're putting the right players around the table, to try to figure out a financial model that will make paying for these drugs feasible. But the problem is we don't I mean, another part of the problem is that we only understand gene therapy so well. Gene therapy, you know, there's an argument for it to be kind of compensated the way you would pay for a house or a car as a depreciating asset. Well, I guess a house isn't a depreciating asset.
You hope it's not.
I guess it depends on the house. But the problem is gene therapies, they're being compared to a cure and in many cases being priced as a cure, but no one actually knows if that's entirely true. The effects might fade over time. It's not clear if it's going to work in every person. So any kind of payment plan that's set up as though this was a cure is flawed. So the bottom line is we don't have a great system. So our system is not set up for how do we pay for these drugs. It's complicated to figure out what this model should look like. And it's a rapidly evolving space with the FDA's expectations, as I mentioned earlier, that they're going to be approving 10 to 20 of these each year for the next 6 years. The clock is ticking. And we had, as is also pointed out in this article, it's in our best interest to figure this out while the market is still small. So it's kind of like the difficult discussion of around something that we generally talk about with excitement and promise and hope is the reality that these are going to come with some pretty hefty price tags, and we don't have a healthcare system in the U.S. that is set up currently to figure out what that means.
Yeah, that's problematic. In 2017, we did talk about when gene therapy, we specifically on this podcast talked about Luxturna and the costs and the speculative, what it may cost. But, you know, these things are turning into reality. And like you said, with what, 10 to 25 in the next how many years?
10 to 20 new drugs approved each year over the course of the next 6 years between now and 2025. So, I mean, we're going from one in late 2017 to well over 100 by 2025.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
That's a big difference. And it sounds as though we haven't made a whole lot of headway on the pricing end of things.
No. And one of the things I liked about in this article is there was a graphic talking about the gene therapy drug Luxturna.
You took a little exception to this graphic, though.
I did. It says that the drug costs $850,000, and that's the equivalent to buying, and it lists six things. 4 years at NYU for four students, 31 new Toyota Corolla cars, 100-plus year supply of expensive eye medication, one private island.
Which also, what's this private island? But go ahead.
850 iPhone Xs or iPhone 10s.
Either one will work. Yeah, that's fine. We're not an iPhone pocket.
And this is the one that I took the exception to.
Uh-oh.
The equivalent, $850,000 is the equivalent to buying a four-bedroom house in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And as a fellow Midwesterner, I know houses in Pittsburgh are not that expensive. Pittsburgh's not that nice. No offense, Pittsburgh.
Wow, shade thrown at Pittsburgh.
I mean, I am a Cleveland Browns fan and you know, the Steelers. But the sources for these were Zillow, Toyota, Private Islands Incorporated.
Well, what are they all about?
I don't know. We should Google them. And Good RX.
Okay.
But yeah, so then I went on Zillow myself to look at these $850,000 four-bedroom houses in Pittsburgh, and most four-bedroom houses in Pittsburgh are $250,000, $300,000.
Right.
You know, like, there's the rare, like, super nice and
so
super
you could be
nice
living pretty high and large in a four-bedroom house for $850,000 in Pittsburgh.
Like, yes. So I'm. It's not the best. You can get a four-bedroom house in Los Angeles for that amount of money.
So Business Insider, we appreciate the article. We appreciate less so the infographic with the house stuff.
Yeah, like someone who created this infographic has either A, never bought a house, B, doesn't know about the Midwest and how you can get big houses for not so much money there.
Maybe they're living on a private island. Who knows?
Potentially. But anyways, this interesting article and an interesting conversation that we need to continue.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, it's weird times that we're entering into. It's really weird. All right. Well, if you want to take a look at the article yourself, you can find the link in the program notes or check out Business Insider, program notes in the podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com.
And once again, we'd like to thank the Von Willebrand Disease Series from Bloodline as being our segment sponsor.
You can find that at bloodlinepod.com. And one last time, just want to remind you that the presenting sponsor of the Bloodstream podcast is Takeda. And for that, we say thank you, Takeda. All right, now on to Mama Sue. And it's time once again for what's become my favorite segment because it makes sure that I speak to my mother once in a while. And that is Mama Sue's Netflix Rex with none other than my mom, Mama Sue. Hi, Mom.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you doing off quite a lot of watching that you've done? Just yesterday, you were telling me you had to rewatch some stuff to make sure you were properly prepared for this segment. You have such a level of professionalism. I really do appreciate it.
I know. I couldn't believe I had to do that, but I had watched it so, you know, several weeks ago and I couldn't find my notes, so I had to rewatch everything.
Well, let's start with one that I'm afraid is going to be a little bit depressing, and that is What the Health. Tell us about What the Health.
This was a fantastic documentary. It's by a young man from San Francisco who is a self-proclaimed hypochondriac because both his parents, grandparents on both sides had died from heart disease. So he really started out just going to the American Heart Association and the American Diabetic Association, just trying to find out some tips and preventative lifestyles. And he found out a lot more than he ever wanted to find out. Oh, what can I say? Basically, we should all be vegan, which I suppose we all kind of know this. But apparently the American Heart Association, the American Diabetics Association, Susan B. Komen Association, they all take money from KFC, from McDonald's, from the egg board and the dairy board. And there's a funny little thing in this documentary. A lady is making scrambled eggs for her child, and there's cigarettes in the eggs. And she scrapes the eggs and cigarettes onto the plate because we all know cigarettes are a class one carcinogen. But did you know so are egg yolks, bacon, sausage, processed meats, and dairy? I didn't know any of this.
Yeah, I see on their website, they have the World Health Organization report has classified bacon and sausage as carcinogenic to humans.
And they say that if you have to put it on cigarette packs, you should, and it's the same level as cigarettes. Each time you eat an egg yolk, it's equivalent to smoking 5 cigarettes, which blows my mind. I mean, are we going to stop eating eggs? I mean, I probably am not, but it might make you eat one egg instead of two. Who knows? Even with organic food and organic meat and fish, they said that all the farms and the rivers are polluted anyway. So the fish that you get from the ocean and the rivers, they are all full of mercury and they're all polluted also. So, and they said it's a total fallacy that you need meat and chicken and fish for protein. They said, where do you think the cow gets their protein from? Which is so true. I never thought of that. So I would recommend that documentary. There's so much in it that I'm not even saying. It's very, very interesting.
I feel like it might be a good time to watch it too, because, you know, people are looking at the summer. Everybody wants to be in a little bit better shape for the summer. You start, you know, if you waited until the fall, you start coming up on Halloween and the holiday season. Everybody's overeating anyway and eating lots of sweets, Thanksgiving and the bad weather. You just want to be in front of like a fire and eating a lot of food. It feels like March is a good time to digest, as it were, this really depressing information about how everything we eat is terrible.
And, you know, there was one other thing that I, as a nurse, didn't even realize this. You know, sugar is not what makes a person diabetic. And I've said so many times over the years to patients, you know, stay away from sweets, cut down on your sugar. The reason sugar gets trapped in the vessels is because the vessels are full of fat and cholesterol. And the glucose can't get out of the vessels to go to the cells. So it stays there. So when you check someone's blood sugar, that they're going to have high sugar. But it's not the sugar that made them diabetic. It's the fatty, cholesterol-filled vessels. And I just said, wow, I never thought of it that way. So now I'm actually teaching the patients totally different, saying totally different things to them since I found that out.
Well, that's good. You're able to put the knowledge to use. You know, this is actually, I guess this is all the stuff that's in the film, whatthehealth.com/facts. Only 5 to 10% of cancer is genetic, according to the American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute. I think just walking around idea is that cancer has so much more to do with genetic. Obviously, I know there's behavioral things, but 5 to 10% is quite low. So much of it really is our behavior and our environment. After you watched this and ate a bunch of eggs and bacon and chowed down on some delicious ice cream, and what else did you find yourself watching?
I watched this. This is what I watched again. Conversations with a Killer, Ted Bundy.
And you found it so interesting you watched it twice, huh?
Actually, the first time I watched it, I said, I will never watch this again with this psychopath. Even in death, I don't want to give him any attention. But I just said, let me watch it one more time, because actually watching it a second time, it's four episodes. You know, there's a lot of psychopaths among us. I know that. But they don't all look like John Wayne Gacy and Son of Sam and who is that one from the Manson. They don't look, this guy, as we all know, was attractive, educated. It was really creepy watching it, and that he escaped from jail three times, twice in Colorado, once in Florida. And on his escapes, he killed more people. And he was so just terrible, arrogant, all through the different trials. I mean, if people watch it, they'll see. So indignant that he was being accused, and quite sure he would not be found guilty. And thank God he was. And he only started confessing the day of his execution, or the night before. He started giving a little bit of information. So he confessed to about 30, but they believe that there's about 100 women that disappeared in those areas that Washington, Idaho, Utah, Colorado, and Florida. A real sick person. And he said in the documentary, and apparently, I mean, his mother, she's in the documentary a bit. I mean, a lot of mothers are like that, not my child. He swears he did not have a bad childhood. He wasn't abused. He wasn't, you know, bullied or anything else. I mean, some of the neighbors said that he didn't really fit in with people, but his mother loved him supposedly, and he loved his mother. So there was the father, I was not in the picture. So I don't know how people like that, are they born? Are they? He seems to have been born this way. He doesn't seem to have anything in his past that made him this way.
You mentioned not wanting to watch it again and to give this guy even in death more attention. That's something I've been thinking about recently, especially when it comes to true crime. And we seem to have such an interest in crime and unsolved crime and horrific crime. And there's more and more documentaries and audio documentaries and podcasts about it. And is this good? Like, should we be this obsessive culturally with crime and killers?
Well, I don't think we should be, but even with this guy, you know, there were these two reporters that in 1980, when he went to death row, they went there for 9 years. All these audio, you hear all the audio tapes they took on little old fashioned tape recorders, and they hated every minute of it. But I'm through with Ted Bundy now.
Yeah. Was there anything in particular? Was there anything in particular, just as a final question on it, on your second watch, that because it was, you know, it's interesting watching something for a second or a third time because different things jump out to you. Was there anything that jumped out to you yesterday when you were watching it again?
Well, he did have, you know, a seemingly normal girlfriend that I don't know if he lived with her, but she was a regular girlfriend for years. And it's just funny how he actually could compartmentalize the things he'd be doing in the afternoon and then go and be with her and her child and make popcorn and watch TV with her. He never abused her or beat her or did anything. So it's just interesting, like the split personality. But, you know, if there's anyone that would be deserving of the death penalty, and I have very mixed feelings about it, this guy absolutely deserved it. It was almost too good for him.
And both of those are What the Health and Conversations with the Killer are on Netflix, as is the third piece that you're covering this month. Why don't you tell us about that?
This third piece is called Prohibition. It's a film by Ken Burns. It's a couple of years old, and it's very interesting. We all know that Prohibition happened in the early 1900s, but it just shows really back then how destitute and poor most people were anyway. And all the recent immigrants all had their own kind of alcohol that they brought with them. The poor women were having a baby every year and getting beaten and getting marital rape. There was no police help. The men, there's pictures and drawings of people, men laying in the street and women with in rags with babies hanging on them. I mean, the government and I mean, the religious Protestants are the ones that started it up. But they did it because they said for a moral reason, but also because the society was falling apart. But like with anything, if you prohibit something, it only makes it more attractive. And it was just interesting how it became, you know, an underground thing, and the different mobs got involved. And it was funny, though, one part, and it said, you know, they did always allow prescription alcohol. Like you could give someone a prescription for 3 pints of whiskey a month. So the whole family, if you had enough money to go to the doctor, they'd all come down with the same condition, like a husband, wife, and 5 children. And so you'd all get prescriptions for your alcohol.
Yeah, what was the prescription? What did you have to, what ailment did you have to have where the doctor was like?
They didn't specifically say, but I got the idea it was pretty easy to get. And also religious wine was allowed. So they had like all these Irish people like named McGrath becoming rabbis, Black Americans becoming rabbis so they could get the wine. It was just kind of funny, like the things people went through to get their alcohol. But then after World War One, not after World War One, the Civil War, the government, no, World War One, they were so desperate for money that they reversed it in 1933 so they could tax it. They taxed it, I think they said 14%, which was a lot of money.
Well, it's funny you mentioned like how easy you could get it from a doctor, how it wasn't that hard to get, and how ultimately it was...
Was never, never forbidden.
And it reminds me of marijuana now in a way where, you know, in the states where it's medically available, in the states now where it's recreationally available, it doesn't take a whole heck of a lot to get the medical clearance for medical marijuana. And the marijuana industry is like begging to be legalized and regulated. And one of the arguments is, look at all the tax dollars it would bring in and people are doing it anyway. There's just,
right.
There's so, you know, it seems so similar to where we were almost exactly 100 years ago with alcohol.
Exactly the same. That's what I thought also. Yeah.
All right. So there's three very different, speaking of health, so there's three very different options with What the Health, Prohibition by Ken Burns, and Conversations with a Killer. Is there anything else that you're been watching recently or thinking about watching or care to share with the net, with the Bloodstream audience?
Well, I have been watching for a couple of weeks, Bromwell, which is, I think I mentioned it already. It's several seasons. About a lady doctor in Victorian England and how difficult it was for her to start her practice and be accepted and be respected. I like a lot of the English ones, so I'm working on that one. I'll talk about that one soon.
Okay. There's a little sneak peek at what's to come from Mama Sue's Netflix recs. Well, thanks as always for putting the time in to share your thoughts on what you're watching with us. And we'll hear from you again next month.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Last but not least, it's not least, it's just last, parting shots. One last bit to leave the audience with, bleeding disorders related or otherwise. Natalie, what is your parting shot for March, episode 34 of the Bloodstream Podcast?
Well, first I want to say happy St. Patrick's Day, which was yesterday.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, which was yesterday.
That's exciting. But that's not my parting shot. My parting shot is I wanted to share what we started doing this month, and that's bullet journaling.
Well, share away. Share with the people how we now journal in the Lynch household.
So we started, we got these bullet journals, and they are awesome. I mean, they're blank journals, but it's a style of journaling, and there are a million YouTube videos of this bullet journal community that it helps organize your life, it helps organize your schedule, tracks habits, and it's an analog and artful way to kind of connect pen to paper and see how you're spending your time and kind of also catalog your life a little bit.
There's like cool videos on ways to set them up. And while the intention of it is to be like accessible for rapid note taking and to just generally be something that you can go to relatively quickly and without too much setup, it can be comprehensive in the way that it captures all kinds of things in your life. Some people really take the design elements
of it very, very seriously.
Which, like, hey, if that's great, I mean, why not, right?
Yeah, I mean, my as designy as I got was putting like little dots on like the tops of letters. I don't know what that's called, where you like, you know, like at the bottom of the N and the top of the N and the bottom of the N and the top.
I think it's putting little dots at the letters as we
go. Yeah, well, I'm sure it's there, you know, but that's like the extent of my design. Little smiley face.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is your parting shot?
My parting shot is that we are very excited over at Believe Limited to announce that Bombardier Blood has received a new executive producer in one Ms. Alex Borstein. So we are very excited to have Alex, who is a member of this community, on board as an executive producer of this film, which we're all extraordinarily proud of. And her coming on board really adds a lot of credibility to the film. And she's been just an awesome partner since we first started talking about this. So thank you to Alex. And I'm just really excited to be able to share that, and sooner than not to be able to share the film with people. We have screening next month. Actually, what we have screenings later this, we have like screenings all the time. We have so many screenings going on right now, and you can check all those out at bombardierblood.com. There's a image up there of all the screenings to see when there might be one coming to a patient organization event
near you.
And that is all for this episode. Special thanks to everyone at Believe Limited, the National Hemophilia Foundation, Entertainment to Effect Change, the Hemophilia Alliance, and our presenting sponsor, Takeda, as well as our segment sponsors, Breaking Through, the Ask the Expert podcast, Stop the Bleeding, the Teen Impact Awards, and the VWD series from Bloodline. Thanks as well to segment contributors Debbie De La Riva, Amy Bohr, Jonathan Hill, Dr. Glenn Pierce, and Mama Sue Lynch. Subscribe to the Bloodstream podcast and the Ask the Expert podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can email us at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You can find Bloodstream on facebook.com/bloodstreammedia and on Twitter @bloodstreaminfo. You can find the two of us on Twitter as well, but I'm not going to give you those handles. You just have to figure it out. Reminder to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode. My name is Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye, everybody.